You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Patrick Radden Keefe, author of Empire of Pain, Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Also on the program today, Buffalo gets its first socialist mayor. And its first female mayor. Meanwhile, in New York City, mayoral race is still extant. Adams in the lead in the first round. Remember, this is ranked choice. Tiffany Caban, DSA member, may have won her city council race. I have a feeling we're going to be waiting a little while on these things. The voting rights bill filibustered by Republicans. Good news is that the Democrats held. Supreme Court crushes a union's right to organize agricultural workers. And the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which we thought we were going to hear about yesterday, is increasingly looking like it is stillborn. The Delta variant now makes up 20% of U.S. COVID cases. Bernie Sanders shows a little give on the salt cap as he fashions the infrastructure reconciliation bill. Said reconciliation bill may include a path to citizenship for immigrants. The DOJ announces an initiative to crack down on interstate gun sales. And lastly, the newly headed by Lina Khan FTC to scrutinize Amazon's purchase of MGM. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. It is Wednesday. Emma Vigeland is here like she is virtually every other day. In fact, I mean, certainly every other day. I'm just already anticipating your upcoming vacation, but that's more than a week away.
No, it's literally a week from today.
Well,
so
a week from today.
Right. I mean, you got to cherish me while you can.
I think we do that every day.
Not enough.
Well, I'm sorry about that. We will all endeavor to do better. All apologies. Thanks for joining us today, folks. We're going to get to a little bit later in the program the implications of what we saw with the voting rights bill, the For the People Act, that was filibustered by Republicans. There is no good news in terms of the For the People Act. There is some good news for the potential of some voting protection reforms. Not so great news when it comes to voter IDs. And some potentially good news, potentially, in terms of filibuster reform. And we will talk more about that later in the program. However, yesterday was the New York Democratic primary day, and there was some surprises across New York State. In New York City, in some ways, no surprise. I guess the biggest surprise in New York City was that the force that people referred to as Andrew Yang did not do so well. In fact, now understand, this is there is no winner yet. As of this morning, Eric Adams had about 32%. He is he is the Brooklyn Borough president and former police officer. Maya Wiley, former member of Bill de Blasio's administration, former prosecutor and MSNBC, former MSNBC commentator, 23%. Catherine Garcia, 20%. And Andrew Yang, about 12%. You need to get over 50% to avoid sort of the kicking in of ranked choice voting. The difference between Adams and Wiley suggests that it would be very difficult for her to make up that distance in ranked choice. And it's also, I'm hearing, like, it could be possible that we're not going to hear anything on this race for 2 or 3 weeks.
But as you say, though, I mean, the results seem fairly clear. We don't know anything definitively, but Adams has what most experts believe is a fairly insurmountable lead at this point, which is bad news. I saw people comparing it to, you know, the left in Bernie's campaign, where the left was so preoccupied with Pete Buttigieg or whoever the case may be, Kamala Harris. And then, what do you know, it was Biden all along who had the stronghold. And that's kind of where Eric Adams is.
Yes. And to be clear, as I'm listing off those four names at the top, there's only one who has been a ongoing politician who has had 10, 20, 30 years to build an organization and to develop relationships. He was most recently the Brooklyn Borough president. The point that I'm trying to make, though, is that there's going to be attempts to extrapolate from this outcome as to ideology. And the fact that Maya Wiley was not the first choice of progressives, there were multiple candidates, I think, that were ahead of her, but lost their mojo, as it were, because Scott Stringer had some accusations of potential sexual harassment 20 or 30 years ago. And his candidacy was largely abandoned. Morales had her own problems with campaign workers, essentially mutinying. And so Maya Wiley was a late settle for progressives. Your mileage may vary as to, you know, her bona fides, but and for her to get 22-23% is a pretty strong showing relative to the 32% that a guy who has his own machine theoretically did. So to extrapolate, Eric Adams is tough on crime, Maya Wiley is not tough on crime, and to suggest that played a big issue in this election, I think, is silly. And we only need to look to Buffalo, New York, which has had a fairly significant rise in crime over the course of essentially the pandemic, and see that whatever lesson you supposedly could draw from the New York City mayoral race is not one that you can, and I am saying the Democratic primary, it's not one that you can apply other places necessarily, or maybe that narrative is just not true. Here is the socialist India Walton declaring a victory up in Buffalo.
All that we are doing in this moment is claiming what is rightfully ours.
Yes,
we are the workers. We are the workers. We do the work. Yes. And we deserve a government that works with and for us.
And we should say that she beat a four-term incumbent mayor. Obviously, this is the Democratic primary, but
Secures her place as, you know, most likely the mayor in the fall. I mean, some of the things that she promised, signing a tenants' bill of rights, rent control, removing police from mental health calls, all just, you know, important policy changes that she could do fairly immediately. These are her first 100-day promises.
And here she is. If she considers herself a socialist, and so there's no backing away for India Walton.
Yourself a socialist?
Oh, absolutely. The entire intent of this campaign is to draw down power and resources to the ground level and to the hands of the people. And when we think about socialism, you know, we're perfectly fine with socialism for the rich. We will bail out Wall Street and banks and give $1 billion in tax incentives to one of the richest people in the world to build an empty Tesla factory in South Buffalo. And when it comes to providing the resources that working families need to thrive, socialism becomes scary at that point. So I'm very proud to be a Democratic socialist. I am proud to have the support of Buffalo DSA and National DSA. I received a call from Congresswoman AOC this evening, and I'm just excited to be a part of this movement that is ushering progressive politics into Buffalo. Being the third poorest mid-sized city in this country, we should be considering how we begin to eradicate concentrated poverty and disadvantage, and Democratic socialist leanings are a big step in getting us there.
It's going to be fun to see those policies in action.
Yeah, and just her strength. And, you know, I saw on Twitter, too, that Martin Gugino, the old man who was assaulted by Buffalo police, pushed down by them during, you know, police accountability protests, he was at her victory party. So just kind of full circle in terms of the way Buffalo's been in the news recently and what grassroots campaigns can accomplish.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Patrick Keefe, the author of Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. We'll be right back after these words. And here are these words. Today's program. Got a couple of sponsors today. You've heard me talk about Quip. Maybe you've heard me talk about Quip too much. Maybe I got too excited about but I got, I guess now I feel like it's been like 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 years ago, I got very, very, very hyper-conscious about dental hygiene, because you get to be my age, you start to realize like, hey, this is going to cost an arm and a leg. You can't go backwards, folks. So you got to start doing this now. How do you maintain good oral dental hygiene? You develop habits that are easy and are comfortable. And how do you do that? With utensils that are designed well and function well. Quip's electric toothbrush is just that. It's the easiest electric toothbrush to continually use. And their whole system of sending you new brush heads every 3 months makes it super easy. Well, they have extended that, process to mouthwash. As you know, mouthwash has not changed in 140 years. But Quip has created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need, and that comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle. It's 100% recyclable. There's no alcohol in their mouthwash. Kills bad breath germs. It helps prevent cavities. Leaves you feeling fresh. Their 4x concentrate has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC. And they left out the artificial colors. And like I say, they left out alcohol. What happens is you get a customizable subscription. You can get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch to their oral care regime. You can pair it with an electric toothbrush. Both my kids and I have a Quip. You can use their refillable flossers, which I still am amazed with every time I use every day. And they have this great gum that I've talked about in the past with a little Pez dispenser. And I should also mention that for the kids, they have a watermelon toothpaste that my kids love. So check it out. If you go to getquip.com/majority5 right now, you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. Includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-dose day of supply of Quip's 4x concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. That's numeral 5. getquip.com/majority5. Quip is the good habits company. Also, today's ad from Emma's favorite ad read by me.
Here we go.
It's Hello Tushy, the modern bidet. You don't want swamp ass, folks. It's summertime, tough time. Tough time. You don't want swamp ass at all. Hello Tushy, the 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It is super easy to install. All you got to do, you take off the your toilet seat, which just involves you screwing like this. You don't need any extra electricity. You don't need any new plumbing. You tie it right into your thingamajigs. All you got to do is use a wrench. Super easy. It doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself with the Smart Spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. Like I say, it pays for itself in a few months. It cuts down on your toilet paper use by 80%. And frankly, it is the most civilized way to deal with this issue that we all have. I don't even call it an issue. It's just part of life, ladies and gentlemen. And Emma, stop it. Plus, Hello Tushy has
doing anything.
Your ass covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. Have you already got a Hello Tushy? Well, then treat your butt to the new 3.0. And if you're new to the revolution, understand, you could become an evangelist after this. Once you go bidet, you don't go back.
You don't go bidak.
You don't go bidak. That's right. Honestly, folks, it really is a revelation. You understand like why people around the world have been doing it this way, because it just doesn't make sense. You get dirt on your hand. You don't just take a dry piece of paper and wipe it off. Use water. Defeat swamp ass. Go to hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Check it out, folks, honestly. And it's a lot less expensive than you would think to try this out. Lastly, you've heard me talk about Hunt a Killer. It is basically what one of those key things that made it made the lockdown, frankly, tolerable. It is the murder mystery subscription box. It's the most exciting date night you can have at home. For me, it was also the only way that I could get my teenage daughter to communicate with me anyway. She's basically done with every. I thought maybe I'd gotten through it, but it's gotten ramped up. But
I thought you were big on TikTok with this whole Crowder
thing. She's
very
excited about TikTok, what's going on with that whole Crowder thing. But this was one of the few things that we were able to do over the past really a couple of years, where she was totally into it. She had mentioned to me that she was, you know, big into that. What is that Dick Wolf show? You know, all those
Law and Order.
Yeah,
SVU,
Law and Order.
That kind of stuff.
And so I asked her if she was psyched to do this. And we did two of them. We did the one, I can't remember what the name of it was, with the reunion. And then we did Curtain Call, which was Matt, I think, did this with his girlfriend too. It was, you go back 1930s, somebody in real time had found like a body, an entombed body, and you find out it was great. It brings people together. You challenge them to decode ciphers and examine clues. You solve puzzles. What you get is each time they send you every month an update. It's basically a box with documents, evidence, audio recordings. They have case files, and then you go through it systematically. You eliminate suspects. You identify murder weapons. You crack the case. You catch the killer. You could do this on Zoom. You could do it in person. You can mix it up with some people in person, some people on Zoom. It doesn't matter. You can also join Hunt to Killer's spoiler-free online community, and there are thousands of members there that will help you, give you clues. You can work things out together with them. Hunt to Killer has 100,000 active subscribers, over 2,000 five-star reviews. They're basically like a, like, I don't know. It's like a, like they do productions. It's almost like they do a different like a TV series, but you're actually in it. Part of the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation. It's an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. Check it out. Great gift for Valentine's. Well, Valentine's Day is not coming up. What, Father's Day? I guess, whatever. Over the summer.
Happy July 4th.
Exactly.
Here's Hunt a Killer.
Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code MAJORITY for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure you use the code MAJORITY for a 20% discount. Can answer the question, do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? So check that out, folks. I have no idea. I didn't realize that it's not February right now. All right, let's welcome to the program Patrick Radden Keefe. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of multiple books. His latest is The Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, I'm here with Emma Vegelin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Let's just start. And I think like this audience over the years has heard me at multiple legal tort conferences talking about the development of some of the cases against both the Sacklers and ultimately what ended up being some of the distributors around the country for the impact of essentially what the Sacklers have wrought through Purdue Pharmacy and through OxyContin over the years. But sum up for us just, broad strokes, the implications of what the Sacklers developed and marketed on this country over the past 20 years.
Sure. So the Sackler name, I think, was really mostly familiar to people until quite recently as a name that stood for philanthropy. This was a family that gave hundreds of millions of dollars away over the decades to art museums, to universities, to medical facilities. What was less well known was that a big part of the family's wealth had been generated by the marketing and sale of OxyContin, which is a very powerful painkiller. And as you say, the opioid crisis is this very complex crisis that's unfolded over 25 years. But OxyContin was, in the words of one former employee of the Sackler's company, Purdue Pharma, the tip of the spear. It was really the drug, this powerful opioid painkiller that changed the way in which American doctors prescribed these drugs. And there was a lot of marketing, which turns out to have been deceptive, claiming that opioids should be more widely prescribed because they're not addictive. Now, this turns out not to be true. And so that was the role that OxyContin played. And it was very, very profitable strategy for the Sacklers. This single drug has generated about $35 billion in revenue since it was released in 1996, but also a really devastating one for the United States.
And we should say, that by tip of the spear, I mean, people are familiar, I guess, with the idea of like a gateway drug. I mean, this was gateway is not even, I think, is not even accurate in this instance. I mean, it was more like a funnel, right? I mean, there was a certain amount of gravity involved in this, that this was not just opening the door to other drugs. It was really funneling people into drugs. And we've had 500,000 people die of opioid ODs, and they're not responsible.
I don't know how you parse out the responsibility of that to, you know, specifically what number, but this is an extraordinary amount. And obviously, on top of that, you have a tremendous, those are ODs. You have a tremendous amount of addiction that has become, that has burdened, you know, municipalities, yeah, counties, states, families. I mean, the implications of this are just massive, you know, and particularly like when we can sort of look at this past year of COVID and say, this is what it looks like when 600,000 people die and the implications involved around this. I mean, this has been massive. So let's first, because there's been, you know, much written over the past couple of years about the Sackler's, talk about how you, A, reported this book, because you went beyond, I think, where the sort of the initial round of reporting was on this, because of the legal cases, and you also obviously spoke to a lot of people, but tell us about that. And then also your prior history in working with illicit drug dealing and how that sort of a couple of like red flags went off in the course of that when you start seeing what was going on in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to take the second part first, I had written over the years about the illegal drug trade. I'd been really fascinated by the ways in which particularly Mexican drug cartels operate as businesses, the ways in which, you know, they're big criminal enterprises, but they're also big multinational commodities businesses. And I was interested in how they make determinations about, you know, what do they deal in? How far do they, you know, how much do they vertically integrate? All these types of questions. And one thing that I was puzzled by was that after 2010, you suddenly saw a surge in Mexican heroin coming across the border. And I was just wondering what would account for that. And it goes to what you just mentioned, the, you know, the idea of the gateway or the funnel. So it turned out that you had a huge population of people in this country who didn't start out using heroin. They started on prescription pills like OxyContin and then eventually graduated to heroin, which is chemically quite similar in terms of them both being opioids. And that led me to the Sackler family. So I initially wrote a piece about the Sacklers in 2017 for The New Yorker. And it was one of these funny things where they, you know, I was not breaking the news that Purdue Pharma was owned by this family. That had been out there in the world, but it had been a story that the family had managed to contain, I think, in a really impressive way. And so, certainly in 2017, when I started working on this, museums were still taking their donations. You know, there was no sense that the family name had been tainted by any association with the opioid crisis. That started to change over the last few years, and some of it was that there was more press coverage. I certainly, in my piece, tried to not tell a kind of broad story about the opioid crisis where the Sacklers are one strand in the corner, but really focus closely on the family and their accountability. But you also saw states which had sued Purdue Pharma. At this point, pretty much every state in the union is suing Purdue. But some states, starting with Massachusetts, started to also sue individual members of the Sackler family. And then you got activism by people like the photographer Nan Golden. And so more and more attention started converging on the family. And as that happened, you started getting more documents which had previously been secret coming out. So that was both through litigation, where they were produced in litigation and anybody could access them. And then as I got into my reporting, I also had people leaking things to me. Because it was important for me that if you're going to tell the story of this billionaire family who, you know, they wouldn't speak to me, they were threatening to sue me since I started working, I didn't want it to feel like you were looking at them through a telescope. I wanted some sense of intimacy. And so it's helpful to have their own private emails and know the way they talk about this crisis behind closed doors.
How integral was the Bush era DOJ settlement to kind of keeping a lid on the Purdue family's complicity in this rising crisis? Because, I mean, it's fairly laughable when you look at the figures that they settled for. And it obviously, as you say, it didn't gain traction in the way that it we're seeing it now until, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such an important point. So the, you know, on the one hand, I'm focusing very closely on this family in the book and their culpability. On the other hand, this is a story about systemic failure, just totally widespread systemic failure, instances in which all of the relevant kind of public institutional gatekeepers that are supposed to prevent a public health crisis like this from happening didn't do their jobs. And DOJ is right at the front of the line there, because what happened was in 2007, as you said, you had a U.S. Attorney's Office in the Western District of Virginia that had spent 5 years investigating Purdue and indeed investigating the Sacklers, and wanted to bring a really powerful case against them, thought they had a powerful case against the company. What they wanted to do was charge three senior executives at the company with felonies. And then the plan was, as is often the case, if you did that, at least one of them would flip and turn on the Sacklers, and then they would go on and potentially prosecute the Sacklers themselves, who owned and controlled the company. But what happened was, at the 11th hour, the family and the company sent some of their well-connected fixers from both sides of the aisle. So they had Rudy Giuliani on the one hand, but also Mary Jo White, former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, who would become the head of the SEC under Obama. The two of them appealed to the political leadership at the George W. Bush Justice Department, and essentially defanged this case. What happened was that the brass said to the U.S. attorney in the Western District of Virginia, you can't charge these guys with felonies. So at the point where those guys are just going to plead to misdemeanors, there's no threat of jail time, there's no way they're going to turn on the Sacklers. And so what you ended up with was a guilty plea by the company, and then a $600 million fine, which, to one way of looking at things, is a lot of money. But I can tell you, you know, I interviewed somebody who worked at the company who saw the company's CFO say, that's nothing to us. We've had that money in the bank for years. This was a speeding ticket. It was a fine at a time when the company was making billions of dollars a year.
It's functionally like I have a delivery truck and I get a parking ticket now and then. I mean, that's just part of the cost of doing business.
Totally.
All right. So let's go back. The first third or so of the book is dedicated to a guy who wasn't even alive when this happened. But Arthur Sackler, was innovative. It's hard to use that word on some level because it's sort of, but he essentially developed, it seemed, the concept of medicine as an entrepreneurial exercise. Tell us about Arthur Sackler and about that dynamic, where he basically, you know, he turned medicine into really a full-on commodity.
Yeah, I mean, this was certainly the biggest creative choice in writing the book was, as you say, to focus a third of the book on a guy who dies before the introduction of OxyContin. But I think Arthur Sackler was a sufficiently important figure that the decision is justified. You know, it's not just that he was the wacky uncle who there are great stories about. For me, it was really more that you can see in Arthur Sackler's story in embryo everything that happens later with OxyContin. So, you know, originally there are three Sackler brothers. Arthur is the oldest. His younger brothers are Mortimer and Raymond. They grow up they're the children of Jewish immigrants in Brooklyn. They grow up against the backdrop of the Great Depression. And all three of them go on to become doctors. But they were also very entrepreneurial. And Arthur, in particular, had, I think, a kind of idealistic sense in the 40s and 50s that there were amazing things happening in the pharmaceutical industry, that someday there'd be a pill that could fix every human affliction. And he wanted to be there for it and to make money in the process. And so he goes into pharmaceutical advertising, which at the time was kind of a backwater. But Arthur had this sort of Don Draper style intuition about how you sell things to people, and specifically, you know, how you sell things not just to consumers, but to doctors. He realized that what you really need to do is persuade the doctor, because the doctor has the prescription pad, and that's incredibly valuable to a pharma company. And so he employs a whole bunch of tricks. Some of it is just getting an army of pharmaceutical reps to go out and meet with doctors and pharmacists and nurses and make the case. They always have this kind of official looking medical literature, which has often been underwritten by the pharma companies themselves. They're always overplaying the therapeutic benefits of the drugs, underplaying the downsides. And in some cases, in when Arthur was working, just lying outright about their products and who it is that's endorsing them. And so Arthur really devises this model. There's a guy who was a business partner of his back in the 50s who said, when it comes to medical advertising, Arthur Sackler invented the wheel, that he really was that significant in terms of changing the way in which medicine and commerce are mingled in this country. And so he does die in 1987, but having made a huge fortune marketing Valium. This is one of the things that's so fascinating, is the first great Sackler fortune came from the marketing of Valium in the 1960s. And I think that Arthur really created a playbook that his family, his brothers, and particularly his nephew Richard, would then employ to devastating effect with OxyContin.
And ultimately, you know, I guess I feel like it was maybe in the past decade where there were more restrictions on the ability of like sales agents and their relationships with doctors. But that is the when you see the I guess the flow of particularly in the case of OxyContin, that doctors, and assuming, you know, the vast majority of them are, you know, scrupulous, there are some that were, I think were problematic. I mean, specifically, were criminal in some respects, but for the most part, they don't have the bandwidth to assess what a sales agent from a place is telling them. And, they don't have necessarily the bandwidth of reading all the studies about every single drug they have. But us as patients just presume that our doctors should know, right? I mean, that seems to be like one of the key breakdowns in the system. There's another on the distributor side with like McKesson and Cardinal and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be one of the key breakdowns in what happened here.
That's exactly right. You've put your finger on it. I mean, the you know, I think from childhood, right, we grow up with this sense of doctors as like rabbis or priests, you know, that they're kind of unimpeachable, that they have our best interests in mind. There's the Hippocratic Oath, and there's a sort of intimacy to that relationship in which I think a lot of us have an almost childlike relationship to our physicians, where there's this sense that, you know, I don't know enough to know what this constellation of symptoms indicates, but you do, and I'm putting my health in your hands and I will take your guidance. And I think that it starts with Arthur Sackler, but now there's obviously a huge juggernaut of an industry devoted to doing this, which is creating a wedge between the patient and the physician, where industry can kind of come in and influence those decisions. And one of the things that was astonishing to me as I got into the marketing of OxyContin is just how varied it is. As you say, I mean, there are bad doctors, there are crooks who run pill mills, and they know very well that they're writing medically unnecessary prescriptions and, you know, maybe getting kickbacks for it. But there are also a lot of well-meaning doctors who see a patient in pain. They want to relieve that pain. And suddenly there's a solution that they're told has no real downsides. You know, the company would say OxyContin is the drug to start with and to stay with. There's a sense that you can use it indefinitely with no real side effects. You don't need to worry about addiction, and it can ease terrible pain. And then in between, you have all of this whole arsenal of persuasive techniques. So in many instances, what this would entail would be, the company sponsored thousands of pain management seminars, and the idea is, oh, this is education, really. But so you say to a physician, listen, you're not taking pain seriously enough. What would you think about an all expenses paid trip to Boca Raton? You know, come down for 2 or 3 days. We'll have some nice meals, there'll be some entertainment, and you can listen to some talks about how best to manage pain. And the whole thing is underwritten by this company that has this painkiller. If you talk to physicians, often they'll tell you that they're sort of aware of the motivations of big pharma, but they'll also say, oh, you know, but I'm not influenced by it. It's like people who, you know, they watch the Super Bowl commercials and they say, oh, it's entertaining, but of course I would never change my consumer behavior. And it's funny because this is just not true, right? So it turns out there are studies on this. If you buy a meal for as little as $15 for a doctor, you can change the way that they prescribe. And Purdue Pharma some years was spending up to $9 million a year just to buy food for doctors.
Wow. All right. Now I want to put a flag in that because we will come back to it when we talk about the development of cotton, of the coating that starts with MS cotton, and because we will work our way up to where doctors really did not understand what OxyContin was relative to what the MS cotton was, in terms of its strength. And the Purdue was aware of that dynamic, but let's start with the development of MS cotton, which is, I guess, the first sort of innovation that leads to this.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, Purdue Pharma, this company that the Sacklers own, originally the family bought it in 1952. It was an old pharmaceutical company called Purdue Frederick, which had started in Greenwich Village at the end of the 19th century. And Arthur Sackler basically buys it for his brothers. And for decades, it trades in these pretty unglamorous products. I mean, they had a laxative, they had an earwax remover. It's these kind of over-the-counter staples, but not very innovative drug development. But eventually they do start to do their own R&D, and they come up with this cancer drug called MS-Contin. And the idea was that this is a morphine pill, but with a special seal that allowed the morphine to slowly disperse into the bloodstream over a number of hours. And so Contin, short for continuous. And MS Contin was basically just pure morphine, but you would take it. And what this meant was that people who had terrible cancer pain or were in an end-of-life situation could be at home, that they didn't need to be in the hospital getting dosed with morphine, that they could just take these pills. And MS-Contin was a big success for the company, totally out of proportion with anything that had come before. But as we know, you know, what success in the pharmaceutical business is all about the patent and the premium that you can charge when you have the exclusive patent to produce a drug. And eventually the patent for MS-Contin was going to be running out. And so the company was kind of casting around looking for other painkillers that they could sell with this Contin system. And they landed on oxycodone, which is another opioid, very powerful, been around for the better part of a century. And so the idea was if we took a big dose of oxycodone and this Contin seal, we could come up with a really powerful painkiller called OxyContin. The strange thing about this is that when they're looking into it, they realize that doctors and focus groups have the misapprehension that oxycodone is weaker than morphine, when in fact it's about twice as strong. And so there are these amazing emails that I got my hands on where senior people at the company, including Richard Sackler, have these discussions about this oddity that the doctors seem to misunderstand the product that Purdue is now selling. They had MS-Contin, they have OxyContin, and doctors think that oxycodone is weaker than morphine when the opposite is true. And in these emails, what they say is, let's not do anything to make those doctors realize they have it wrong. Let's let them continue to believe that the stronger drug is the weaker drug. And the reason they wanted to do that was they weren't satisfied with the cancer pain market. They thought, you know, what if we position OxyContin as a drug really for everyone, for the tens of millions of people who suffer from chronic non-malignant pain of various sorts? That's the market we want. And so if doctors think that it's actually a milder treatment and not a stronger one, they'll be more likely to prescribe it for that kind of pain.
And we could substitute the words less addictive and more addictive for stronger and not stronger. And so you had doctors prescribing a more addictive substance for, like you say, ailments that were not like at the, you know, potentially terminal. They're doing it for, you know, chronic back pain. And so this is, I mean, this ends up being really the key ingredients into creating this mass addiction, right? Is that you've got doctors prescribing something they think is less addictive for, and so therefore they also feel comfortable in prescribing it for situations that are not acute. And it has obviously it ends up becoming a massive disaster.
Yeah, and not just less addictive, but not addictive at all. I mean, the whole marketing push for OxyContin. So first of all, I should say the company didn't do any tests on addictiveness prior to releasing the drug, even though humans have known for thousands of years that products derived from the opium poppy can be quite addictive. But they had this kind of, I think what you could generously call a conjecture, which was that because of that content coding, that what that would mean is that the drug was kind of, it sort of regulated the flow of the drug into the bloodstream, and you wouldn't have these like highs and lows where you get a kind of immediate dose and some euphoria associated with that, followed by the kind of valley of withdrawal when you don't have the drug in your system. And so they had this guess, basically, which is they said, well, maybe that means it's not addictive at all. And they ran with that guess, essentially claiming that it was a scientific conviction, and told thousands of doctors across the country, I mean, hundreds of sales reps. I've interviewed these people. They said we would go in and we would say it's addictive less than 1% of the time. With a straight face, you know, look them in the eye and say, you don't need to worry about that. It's addictive less than 1% of the time. And they would repeat that again and again and again. And there was no scientific basis for making that claim.
And so this is both a failure of the FDA and, frankly, just of the regime of what we have with drugs. It is obviously, I find it hard to believe that they didn't, you know, that Purdue wasn't aware. I mean, it was one of those things like, we just don't want to know about the addiction. But they also did an end around with, I think, just to go back, with MS-Contin that is reminiscent of like what we see almost like with Uber in some way. They came in and busted through the regime and basically created facts on the ground and then go backwards. Will you just tell that story as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So MS-Contin was actually developed in the UK, and it was sold there initially. And then they were going to roll it out in the US. And normally, if you have a new drug, the rules are pretty clear. You need to file what's called a new drug application with the FDA. And get it. There's an approval process. You know, we could talk about how thorough and precise that process is, but there is a process. It exists. It's a bureaucratic process. It takes some time. And then the FDA eventually says, all right, you're approved to sell this to US consumers. What happened with MS-Contin was that a canny lawyer who subsequently pled guilty to a federal misdemeanor at Purdue said, what if we just sold it on the assumption that because it's morphine, the only active ingredient is morphine, and morphine has been around for a long time and has already been approved, we don't need to file a new drug application. It's really not that new. So you have this kind of funny thing where on the one hand, internally, they all say, oh, this is a groundbreaking drug. It's a game changer. Look at, you know, like, give us a pat on the back because we've revolutionized the management of pain. But then for regulatory purposes, they say, oh, this is really just morphine. It's just morphine with this content coding. So they just sold it. They just started selling the drug. And by the time the FDA caught on to this and sent them a cease and desist letter and said, listen, you know, you never filed for an application. You need to stop now and do a new drug application. There were already a lot of patients who were relying on the drug. These are people with cancer who were relying on it for pain. And so you ended up in this kind of negotiated situation where the company sends all its lawyers down. They prevail on, at the time, the Reagan administration to let them keep selling it and then retroactively apply for the new drug application for this drug that is already on the market, which is what they ended up doing.
I feel like we could do probably just an hour on the FDA process, because this is the way, this is also indicative of how other drugs, they will get approval for one treatment. They will do off-label treatments with these drugs, which presumably the drug is safe, but how you apply the drug and how you market, and that's basically what the marketing is, right? I mean, the marketing is essentially directions for use of the drug. It gets filtered through the doctor. It gets implied. The doctor thinks, well, you're able to do this. It doesn't say it exactly, but trust me, you can take it three times a day or whatever it is. You can take it for this ailment. And this is where we run into all sorts of problems with drugs, because it's constantly these pharmaceutical companies trying to find new ways in which they're going to sort of repurpose drugs that have gotten approved for one thing, one application, and they're going to use it for a different application so they can expand their market once they've saturated.
Absolutely. And you know, it's funny. So when you get a bottle of pills from the pharmacist, there's that little packet with the kind of dense fine print inside that you probably don't read. It's called the packet insert, the package insert. And it is a very carefully negotiated document. There's a lot of drafting and back and forth between the company and the FDA. Richard Sackler, who for a time was running Purdue Pharma and was really sort of the father of OxyContin, he described the package insert at one point for OxyContin as, you know, our most potent selling instrument, right? So for him, this is a marketing document. And in terms of the FDA and you know, how much stock we should put in their ability to be judicious when it comes to playing their role as regulator, I think it's instructive to look at the approval of OxyContin later. So after MS-Contin, you know, retroactively gets its new drug application approved, they want to roll out OxyContin and they apply for approval. They do a new drug application. There's a guy named Curtis Wright, who's the head official at FDA in charge of kind of policing this product. He's the guy that they need to satisfy, both that the drug is safe and efficacious for U.S. consumers, but also he needs to sign off on the marketing claims, which are, in some cases that turned out to be pretty outlandish. So Curtis Wright signs off on it. Drug breezes through in record time, takes less than a year, gets approved. Curtis Wright leaves the FDA. Right. And within a year, he goes to work for Purdue Pharma for three times his government salary. So, you know, that's not a suitcase full of money getting passed under a table. But I wouldn't say it's not corrupt on some level.
Yeah. And I think there's at least, if I recall correctly, one other example of somebody who had worked on one side of the regulatory scheme and ended up working for Purdue. I want to get to, we don't have too much time. I want to get to some of the sort of the horrors of this, this family in terms of their lack of empathy. And we should say in fairness to the heirs of Arthur Sackler, that when they sold it to Raymond and Mortimer, that some of the Sackler family was like, we were never part of that. I think they referred to them as like the Oxy Sacklers or something. And Mortimer apparently at one point like just even questioned whether there was an opioid crisis. Tell the story about, just you choose which story from the book do you think exemplifies their complete lack of empathy and failure to accept any responsibility for this. I mean, it's stunning. But then I want to ask you about the sort of the structural implications, but yeah. In terms of that family.
I mean, I was, you know, for me, it was interesting, right? Writing this big book about a family and none of them would cooperate with me. And it was interesting because for a long time, I thought there must be some apostate. There must be some family member, some third generation Sackler who's uncomfortable about all this opioid money and has questions about what they've done. And it turned out there really isn't. I ended up getting hold of a lot of internal email, a family WhatsApp log that ran over a year. And what's so striking is that internally they all have this kind of bunker mentality, this sense that, you know, so every state in the union is suing the company. Half the states are suing the family. Congress has held hearings. You have books. You've got research studies. You've got journalistic accounts. Thousands of lawsuits. I think it's literally something like 3,000 lawsuits. I think a pretty broad, uniform consensus that this company and this family played a special role. They weren't the only ones, but they played a special role in sparking the opioid crisis. Inside the family, their perspective is, we're just misunderstood. All those people are wrong. You know, we in our small circle of paid advisors have seen the truth, which is that we really never did anything wrong. As you say, Mortimer Sackler referred to it as the so-called opioid crisis. They put a lot of emphasis on the idea that, that today it's a heroin and fentanyl crisis, even though it's very, very clear that many people who have started using heroin and fentanyl started out with prescription pills. So I think I was most struck actually by, you know, it's like the dog that didn't bark. I was most struck by it, by the absence of any family member piping up and saying, hey, I'm uncomfortable with this. And you end up with these kind of, you know, it's funny, I had multiple different people who I interviewed who've worked with the Sacklers and for them say that the experience was like being on the show Succession. It's this sort of the experience of like this kind of totally out of touch billionaire family. And so there are these moments in the book where the family has taken all the money out of Purdue Pharma. So there's no money left in the company and they're going to declare bankruptcy and they're looking to come up with a deal to settle this, all these cases by the states. And it's like a couple of days later, Joss Sackler, who's the wife of a third generation Sackler, David Sackler, has a fashion show in New York Fashion Week because she has this like vanity fashion line. And just the kind of tone deafness of this, right? And then, and she, you know, they offered $100,000 to Courtney Love to come and sit in the front row. And Courtney Love came back and said, I was addicted to OxyContin myself. Are you nuts? I mean, how could you ask me to do this? So there are these kind of absurd moments where you see, on the one hand, the sheer toll of the human devastation, and on the other hand, just how out of touch this family has become.
So, I mean, like you describe it as Succession, that sounds like Real Housewives to me, right? With a little bit of the vanity projects in the New York socialite scene. How much money did they run away with? I mean, we know, I guess, the scale of the amount of states that are going after them now. But how wealthy are they still to this day, individually and as a family, even despite the litigation that they're facing?
So we don't know the exact number. There are a lot of people trying to find out the precise dimensions of the fortune, but I can tell you the numbers that have been confirmed through the bankruptcy process. So it's worth backing up and saying this amazing thing happens, which is that the company actually pleads guilty to federal criminal charges twice, once in 2007 and then again in 2020. And in between, the family is quietly taking money out of the company. So at a certain point, the company declares bankruptcy. There's all these lawsuits, and Purdue Pharma just doesn't have any money anymore to fight the lawsuits. But the reason it doesn't have the money is the family has taken, we know, this has been kind of conclusively established, more than $10 billion out of the company in about a decade. So you now end up in this crazy place where you have a company that's in bankruptcy court in White Plains, and all these thousands of creditors kind of fighting over the scraps of what's left of the company. And then on the sidelines, you have the family whose fortune is estimated to be at about $11 billion, at least $11 billion. That's sort of what the Mortimer and the Raymond wings have now. They have offered to pay. They will acknowledge no wrongdoing. They want to make these cases go away. They've offered to pay about $4.25 billion, which, again, it all depends on which end of the telescope you're looking through. On the one hand, that's a lot of money, and states need that money. On the other hand, it's 40 cents on the dollar for what they took out of the company over the course of a decade.
Right. How much do you think this is a story of a unique family, you know, manipulating a system, or a system? And that system, I don't know, you can define the parameters of that, just whether it's just the FDA or frankly, like, you know, are the way that we do medicine in this country. I mean, if we had a single payer system that would or a government that would actually produce these drugs, or, you know, where there wasn't this kind of profit motive, it wouldn't matter if you had, you know, Arthur Sacklers or Mortimer Sacklers running around, because they wouldn't have the opportunity to wreak this kind of catastrophe on a country. Like, how much of it do you think this is a function of the family, and or how much of a function of the structure of capitalism, or the way that we, you know, maybe a smaller structure in the context of American society?
I think it's both. I mean, I think that it's very much a story about the system and the, you know, the failures of the regulatory system, the failure of the justice system. We haven't even gotten into, you know, the failures of the DEA, failure of Congress, you know, the I mean, you can go on and on. Every conceivable check that should be there protecting consumers failed, and often I think was bought off with money and connections. At the same time, the family, this particular family, I think played that system like a harp. And so for me, it's one of those things where if you were to sit around in civics class and talk about the weaknesses of the system that we have, and play it out almost as a hypothetical, right? Like, well, what would the worst case scenario be? You know, how could somebody manipulate this system so that you took advantage of all of its weaknesses and you used money to co-opt people at every single level? How bad could it get? And I think the answer is a public health crisis in which you have more than 2 million Americans addicted to opioids and another 500,000 Americans dead, and a family that is basically going to waltz off into the sunset with a $10+ billion fortune intact.
All right. Lastly, we just have a minute here. I wonder how much do you think, since they seem so thin-skinned, I'm thinking about that time while one of the Sacklers had written, like, it's hard on my kids. Like, people don't understand how hard this is on us. How much did it make a difference? Like when you mentioned, I think, Nan Golden going to the Met. I mean, I remember when she was holding those protests or just like the New Yorker. I mean, writing a piece in the New Yorker is different than like it being in, like, I don't know, USA Today to these people, because they're walking around in circles where people are reading the New Yorker and it's embarrassing for them. How much did that play into this?
I think it's a real thing. I mean, you know, I would be lying if I said that wasn't a consideration for me when I wrote the article in the New Yorker. I knew that the New Yorker is read in the kinds of places where they, you know, where this family resides and circulates and has enjoyed, I think, a degree of, you know, people kind of either not knowing about what they've been up to, or pretending that they don't know. I think there's a reputational cost. I think it's real. I think the name is coming down from institutions. I'll bet it comes down from the Met at a certain point in the near future. I think that's about as bad as it's going to get for them. And so, you know, next to the suffering that you've seen other people experience, I don't think that amounts to all that much. But I do think that this is a family that for a long time has been obsessed with the kind of this like family branding thing of the family name, putting it up on institutions, making that name stand for something. I think they've lost the good name. And I think that's one thing that they're never going to get back.
Well, it's a real shame to see history destroyed that way when they take their name off of those buildings. I'm being facetious, obviously. Patrick Radden Keefe. The book is Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Thank you so much for your time today. Really, really fascinating. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll wrap things up. So now, Emma, you know that I am constantly bringing up lately. I think I'm bringing up more and more these days because after the pandemic, you know, I had missed 3 trips, I think it was, to Vegas. The TORT conference was canceled. Maybe it was 2 trips. And over the years, people can go back and try and find these episodes where I would go to Las Vegas and talk to tort lawyers, and there was various different types of lawsuits. One subset of these lawsuits regarding this opioid crisis was on behalf of counties and municipalities. And they ended up suing the distributors. McKesson was one, Cardinal, there's three major ones. They had a regulatory obligation to track how many pills were going to any specific region of the country. And they basically just looked a blind eye on it. And of course, then you had places like, you know, in West Virginia or in Ohio, where you had millions more pills, you know, like, I don't know, hundreds of pills, thousands of pills per actual resident of the city or the town or the county. Really just a stunning story. And folks can check that out. I guess that's it for us. If you're watching on Peacock, we will be back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. If you are not watching us on Peacock, oh boy, do we have stuff for you in the fun half today. We will get to that in a moment. I just want to remind you, you can support. I will tell you what we're going to see. Something I thought we would never show on the show. But Steven Crowder sort of smoked it out of the internets with his complaint that he couldn't find any video of me doing comedy. I don't know if this is really comedy. People don't realize I had a performance artist.
I mean, you are standing up.
I am standing up. It is kind of funny. Video. But we'll talk about that in a second. I just want to remind people, Just Coffee, Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. The coffee co-op that has been supporting this show for every day of its 11 plus years existence and supported Break Room Live. They are a cooperative. They're movement supporters. They were out giving free coffee to people back in Madison in 2011 at those protests. They are really, really supportive of their producers in Central America and around the world. Frankly, they will not abandon these people, regardless of sometimes they have bad seasons and whatnot. They figure it out. They are celebrating these 11 plus years with us by giving a 25% off any of their coffees, MR25, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MR25 just for this week. Check it out. Good opportunity to taste a varied types of coffee. Meanwhile, you can also become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. And you support this program and allow us to rely on no one but you. So join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, Nomi's show, 3 p.m. today, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. Meanwhile, what is happening in the Leckian_media_universe. Matt.
Yeah, Napoleon the Legend on Left Reckoning tomorrow at 8. Tonight I'm going to be doing my Twitch stream. There's too much basketball going on last night, so I just, you know, wanted to decompress after the alley-oop to Ayton. Tonight I plan to do twitch.tv/literary hangover, probably around 11, a later one, but yeah, check that out, folks. And then we'll have, for patrons of Left Reckoning, patreon.com/left reckoning, a conversation with Megan Day on a socialist school in Arkansas about 100 years ago. So look forward to that.
That game was boring until it wasn't.
What was that, last night?
Yeah.
Was that
Suns Clippers?
Suns Clippers.
Alley-oop at the end.
Yeah. And Paul George missed two free throws. That.
Yeah, but I feel compelled to say that Paul played very well in the first final 3 minutes before that. But anyway,
Let's
let me tease this before we go into the fun half. There was video that was unearthed. I can only tell you that it involves me and some body lotion oil.
Vegetable oil?
We want to get out ahead of this. I'm not going to reveal until we get to the fun half. We want to get out ahead of this. I know that Steven Crowder has been raking the internet for something to embarrass me about. There was a time where I was a performance artist and performed some things that I look back on and am still proud of, but understand that in this day and age may be perceived as a little risque. So stick around for this in the fun half. In the meantime, we give you DJ Janarchy's latest masterpiece.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Danarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflakes says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a, whoa, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money.
Hell of a lot of bank.
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.